Thank you. So about 45 minutes from now.
My wife's test.
I'd like to bring the House Committee on Consumer Protection to order. March 9th. Committee, today we have public hearing and a possible work session on House Bill 2369, House Bill 2325, and slated a public hearing for House Bill 2631. But we're going to go in that order. So at the moment, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2369. Victoria, would you give us a review of this bill and the amendments that are before us?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2369 establishes conditions under which insurer may settle with individual injured in motor vehicle accident, prohibits settlement which is entered into less than 60 days of accident, restricts insurer ability to recover personal injury protection benefits, and does not include clear statement of consequences of entering into a settlement agreement, exempts traffic crash exchange reports prepared by law enforcement from public records disclosure. We have three sets of amendments. -1 amendments establish conditions under which settlement may occur within 60 days of accident and strip the disclosure requirements. -2 amendments eliminate the non-disclosure provisions for traffic crash exchange reports. -3 amendments establish conditions under which settlement may occur within 60 days of accident and specify information contained in traffic crash exchange reports not subject to public disclosure.
Very good. And do we have revenue and fiscal impact statements for those amendments?
Not on the amendments. We have them on the initial bill, but not on the amendments.
So we wouldn't be able to move the bill.
Correct.
Where's the fiscal amendment?
Okay. Thank you. So first up, we have Dr. Vern Sabo and Steve Merle. Good afternoon, gentlemen. It's been a while since we've originally heard this bill, so I know both of you have been in dialogue about possible amendments that you may or may not agree on, but whoever wants to report first and give us a brief review of whatever amendment you wish.
Chair Holley, members of the committee, Steve Merle with State Farm Insurance Companies. This is a piece of legislation that the chiropractic community and State Farm have been working on, a consensus. Last time we met, there were some comments or some opposition to the bill that we tried to address in a -3 amendment. Both the chiropractors, represented by Dr. Sable and State Farm, favor passage of the bill with a -3 amendment. I'd like to kind of address what the -3 amendment does. In Section 2 of the bill, the -3 amendment changes from the original bill text of a prohibition of settlement within 60 days and giving a plain statement of the effect of settlement. Instead, what it does, it allows you to settle with a third-party liability claimant. But if you do it, if you make that settlement within that 60 days, your settlement agreement has to provide that the settlement does not impair that person's right to claim against their own personal injury protection coverage. The concept of it is that a settlement ordinarily would prevent a person from going back to their own insurance carrier getting personal injury protection because it cuts off that carrier's rights to recover their funds. You can get around that through contract, and that's what this bill would require you to do if you first settle within the first 60 days. Most people have, I think, an idea that when they settle that I'm done coming back to the third party to get money. They don't necessarily understand it could affect their own insurance coverage. So within 60 days, what we're proposing is that you have to include in your settlement agreement a provision that allows that person to claim against their personal injury protection and for their company to be able to come back to you, subject to your policy limits, to get the money back. That'll let people continue claiming. We cut it off at 60 days where you wouldn't be required to do it from then on because kind of the idea is at 60 days, you've really got an idea of where you are with injury. Either you should be waiting and finishing out your treatment, or you know that you're at a point where you're well or as well as you're going to get and can make a settlement. The second part of the bill is the part of the bill that's been more controversial, and we got some feedback in the last hearing that we had. Originally, we started out with a non-disclosure of crash reports with some exceptions built into it. if you went to court and showed a public need. Feedback we got from, I believe, the ACLU when they were here last time was is that they would prefer that to go into the public record section where it's permissive disclosure if you show a public need. ORS 192.502 is the absolute prohibition against disclosure of any record. ORS 192.501 is the conditional disclosure of the record. So what we did was we moved our language from that non-disclosure area to the permissive disclosure where any party, anybody in the public who needed that record, who could go in front of the judge and show a public need. Actually, I believe it's an administrative process, but it's a legal process to show a public need. You could get that record. Within that group, we put another set of people that would be allowed to get the record, which includes basically the parties, eyewitnesses to the accident, their lawyers, their insurance company. Another comment we had on the original text of the bill was within that exceptions of people who were allowed to get the record, there was a company called LexisNexis who apparently does get crash reports both for underwriting and insurance purposes for insurance companies. They had written a letter to the chair and asked us to do something that would allow them to continue to get those records. We did that with language that's incorporated in the Dash 3 that LexisNexis provided us and they're comfortable with. The other thing that we've done is instead of having the entire crash report not disclosable, what we've said is you will be able to get the crash report, but they can't disclose personal information. So your name, address, driver's license number, date of birth, those sorts of things would be redacted by the public body disclosing the record unless you went through the process of showing the public need and got the record that way. This originally came up in the context of the chiropractic community identifying an abuse by a particular outlier in their profession that was getting its personal information and using it for marketing purposes. I think if you step back and look at it, this is a lot of this information that you're seeing in this crash report is similar to records that are motor vehicle records. And what we'll be doing by passing this law is not only curing the particular practice that we're putting in front of you, but we'd be putting some sort of control over that information that is in crash reports that we protect when it's in a motor vehicle record, but we don't protect any other way today. Now, within the Motor Vehicle Code in Chapter 802, I think there's a bigger universe of people that can get access to those records, but there's probably a bigger universe of people that have needs, like people who tow cars and have liens against them and those sorts of things. But that summarizes, I believe, what we've done with the Dash 3 and what we've tried to do to reach consensus. I believe the Newspaper Association is still not with us where we've gone. I'm not sure what would satisfy them, but I can answer questions on the Dash 3 amendments if anybody has any. Actually, I guess you.
Dr. Sabo, you want to go ahead and give us your testimony?
Yes, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm just going to address the last piece of the bill, and that's relative to the public disclosure of personal information.
And if you do identify yourself for the record.
Excuse me. Vern Sabo, representing the Oregon Chiropractic Association. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I want to testify to the last section of the bill relative to the solicitation of consumers by individuals. We had one individual in our profession. There are also vendors. Just about anyone off the street can get the crash reports, which have currently personal information, your phone number, your address, social security number, driver's license number, that sort of thing. And there are vendors who actually, for a service, will gather that information and cold call consumers who have been involved in an auto accident in hopes of capturing them as a customer, client, or apparently as a patient. And the last change we made was that, in fact, the newspapers can, in fact, get this information. They can get the consumer's names. They can get the specifics of the crash, the severity, the location, how many individuals were involved, the types of injuries involved, and so forth. But all we're asking in hopes of slowing down this, what we feel is unethical solicitation and actually gets to the point of harassment with phone calling of consumers, is to at the very least not release the personal contact information of consumers, their personal phone numbers, address, and so forth. As chair, members of the committee, that completes my testimony.
So, to make it short, you're both in support of the Dash 3 amendments to this bill.
Mr. Chairman, of the committee, that's correct.
That's correct.
Thank you. Questions from the committee?
Yeah.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can either of you gentlemen walk me through the dash threes and tell me where it's clear in your mind that the newspapers are able to get access, and then the other one was, you were talking about LexisNexis and them being allowed to. Can you point out for me how that works in here?
Yeah. Chair Holdy, Representative Wingard. What we've done is that the newspapers would be able to get a hold of it if they showed a public need, just like anyone else would. And if you look at Section 3, what we did was we put in its place from ORS 192 to 501, the permissive public record disclosure. And if you turn to page 2 of the bill, starting at line 1, and it says the following public records are exempt from disclosure under ORS 192.410 to 192.505 unless the public interest requires disclosure in the particular instance. So that is the public need section of the statute. If they showed a public need, notwithstanding the saying you can't have it, they could get it then.
Follow up. And that includes the LexisNexis?
Chair Holvey, Representative Wingard. No, actually, the LexisNexis people, if you go towards the end of the bill into the bold printed new language, and I'm on the page 9 of the bill, and if you go down to page 14, line 14, it says, agents or vendors acting on behalf of insurers that insure a driver, passenger, or other person alleged to be injured as a result of the accident that is subject to the record being sought. And however, the agent or vendor acting on behalf of the insurer may not use the report for any purpose other than insurance-related purpose for which the report was sought. That was LexisNexis gave us that language that we asked to be put in the bill. The concern I had with LexisNexis was that if you had any company that in general said, I'm gathering it for an insurer and I want to put it now into my database so that anybody else could get it, that was a concern I expressed then, because I see a legitimate need. If you're applying for insurance and you want to show it was a no-fault accident, that your insurer can go get it for underwriting purposes, or if you're in a crash and maybe there's information vital to the investigation of who's responsible for that crash, that your insurer could get it. They gave us a language in there that said it has to be used for the insurance purpose for which it was sought. So a company like LexisNexis that gets that record on behalf of an insurer can only use it for that insurance purpose for which they got it.
Additional follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Follow-up.
Thank you. So if I understand it now, with this change, we would be putting a regulatory burden on LexisNexis. They would somehow or another have to begin patrolling who was accessing this information and for what reason?
Chair Holvey, members of Representative Wingard, my understanding was LexisNexis gave us this language, and they said this fits with their business model.
To do with other states.
Other questions from the committee? Quiet today. Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. I appreciate the work you've gone through to try to get this bill closer to a consensus. So have a good afternoon. Next up, I got Tom Gallagher and Dave Fiscom.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Gallagher, representing the Oregon Newspaper Publishers Association. It's difficult. At first, I apologize for not having been here in the original hearing on this bill. The error is totally mine for having missed this particular provision. It wasn't in 501 at the time. I have over 20 bills this session exempting particular documents from public records and basically running from committee to committee to talk about them. We in the newspaper publishers kind of consider ourselves, along with the broadcasters, the watchdogs of the Public Record Act. If you understand the history of this, there's a presumption in Oregon that all records that are kept by government are open for disclosure. They are public. And we go through a series of exempting certain records for particular reasons from that disclosure. And we have not a particular balancing test. There's not a set of criteria or guidelines. It's up to every committee in every legislative session to decide if a particular act or action means that that record should be exempt from disclosure. Let me give you a couple of examples of those things where we and the newspaper publishers have supported an exemption to give you examples of those kind of things we think are where the public policy for exempting the record from disclosure overrides the presumption of public disclosure. We did one 4 years ago, which will come back up this time, for the Health Sciences Center. And it had to do with a group of activists getting public records from the primate center and going out and finding the people that provided feed or bedding for the animals and going out to their homes and sprinkling blood on their front porch as a means of protesting against animal abuse. We agreed at that time that those records of those personnel that deal with the primate should be exempt from public records, and we will support that exemption, which sunsets this year. Another one that we've done consistently in the past is exempting the names, home addresses, phone numbers, and so forth of law enforcement personnel or district attorneys. There was a case where a particular law enforcement person got a phone call from his wife in the afternoon after making a traffic stop saying that so-and-so had just showed up at their house to threaten her, when all that person had done is gone down and gotten the public record of a deed, public property record of that law enforcement officer. So when physical safety is involved, when the acts are egregious, in this case, as near as I can understand it from my discussions with the proponents of the bill, we really don't have people who are objecting that their records are being abused or misused, except for a couple of individuals who are using them to cold call and solicit clients for a particular medical service. And if you look at their subsection 3, or their dash 3 amendment, they're beginning to now specify people that should have rights to these records. So it's a little frustrating in one sense to say there are some people in the public who have a right to a record and some people who don't, because there was something going on here that I don't agree with and you maybe don't agree with, but I think that this committee has to balance. Is that an egregious enough violation of the disclosure of the record to exempt these records from everybody except these other few people? Now, this just happens to be a record that newspapers use and media use quite often on accidents. I mean, there are certain kinds of accidents and certain issues here that you read about once or twice a month in your newspaper. And the ability to get at somebody's name and phone number, et cetera, you know, it's John Smith. Well, which John Smith? And, you know, we're going to be cold calling how many John Smiths were involved in the accident. You get the records here, you get a hold of the witnesses, you talk to the right people. If this bill were brought, like many of the bills are, by a large group of people who said, oh, there's identity theft going on with my records, I don't like the fact that Social Security numbers are concerned here. I mean, those are things we routinely take out, and I think there's a provision in 501 saying you can redact Social Security numbers. And don't forget that. There are 35 exemptions in 501 to public record disclosure that include personal information, health information, Social Security numbers, that when that record is turned over, they're blacked out. They're redacted right out of the record. So there are protections already in the statute that apply to any public record that's turned over. In closing, I'll turn this over to Dave here, is that I just want to quote from one of the comments from my members here. This type of information is information that has been widely considered basic information that police can give out to reporters under the law and under the widely used press bar bench guidelines. What he's referring there to is that there's a committee that meets with the Bar Association of the press and the judicial folks under the guidance of the State Bar Association, where we go over these things quite routinely as to what should be exempt from public records and what shouldn't. This didn't come through the bar or through that screen that we use, one of the pre-screens that we use. I apologize for being late on this. The dash 2 amendments we could accept. We could probably sit down and go back over the 501 exemptions and see how many of them are actually covered, but it just doesn't reach our criteria that cold calls from a medical provider are a high enough breach of public policy to exempt a full public record. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Dave Fisk, I'm here representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters, 200 radio and TV stations, most of them small businesses, spread around the state. With Tom, I would apologize for failing to be here the first time. With Tom, we're wandering around chasing public records bills throughout this building, and so it's our fault, not yours. I would agree with what Tom said relative to this issue. I don't think the accident records rise to the issue of something which needs to be protected by Oregon's public records law. I'm very familiar with that because for a number of years for state government, 17 years in fact, I helped to administer that law for the agencies where I worked, and I'm very familiar with the exemption process. The kinds of records we're talking about here are records that people use in the news business potentially every day, at least rather routinely, whether it's newspaper reporters or, in fact, the radio and TV stations that I work for in this regard. Our interest probably overall in public records is a little less than is our Tom's clients in the news business, the newspaper business, but at the same time, traffic accident reports are fertile territory for us. Sometimes those could be accidents that result from alleged crimes that have been committed where somebody is fleeing. Perhaps there are deaths involved, and those are our interests for the news business in being able to gather information from those reports without, if you'll allow me to use this word, the impediment of ORS 192-500. I don't think this issue rises to the need for an exemption with all that entails for those who do the work for Oregon's radio and TV stations. With Tom, there may be some middle ground here yet to be found. We're happy to work on that with my friends who appeared before you at the previous panel. That said, we would encourage you to be cautious, if not avoid passing this the sections of this bill that pertain to public records laws. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony, and I appreciate that it's difficult to follow all the bills in this legislature. I have the same problem. But, you know, in just talking real briefly about this, about trying to balance this need to protect individuals' privacy and to protect people from harassment and some of the cold calling from unscrupulous, I suppose, individuals who are seeking to gain a financial benefit somehow from somebody who's been involved in an accident. You know, that's what we're balancing against the need for the newspaper to actually have and publish the address of the people involved in these accidents. And you know, and having all that information, and certainly I can understand you want to have that information to be able to contact these people in some sort of investigative news reporting event, and that has some value to the newspapers and maybe to a lesser degree to the general public. I'm still troubled by, you know, the abuse of this information that's readily available. And so I think you spoke quite eloquently about the trying to balance those needs. And from your perspective, this particular issue doesn't rise to the level of restricting that information from to the press. I think that's something this committee has to consider. And I was prepared to move this bill today, but I don't think I'm even going to adopt the amendments today. I was hoping that maybe you could take a look at those dash 3 amendments a little closer and see if there's some way you can solve your issue without basically publishing this information out there to the world so that we can still protect people from some of the harassment and cold calling that goes on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Tom Gallagher. We will certainly sit down with them again. I don't think my point here was that this makes newspaper publishing easier or that we get that information and that's necessary. My point here is that this record has been available since forever. 1973, we passed the first public record law. Here we are in 2009, and the first time somebody comes in and says they have a member of their profession, there are other professions. There are other both professionals, other medical professionals, trial lawyers, all sorts of people who could have used these records in the same way. And my point here is not that what they're doing is not wrong. My point is I am not satisfied. I'm not personally satisfied. And I asked them a number of times, have they pursued every other avenue to stop members of their profession from using these records in this kind of a way? And so I'm not satisfied in my mind that they've had to go the whole distance to take this public record away from everybody to solve this problem.
Yeah.
Not a fly in the
I appreciate that. I'm just not convinced that there's another way to solve that problem.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair. Tom, would it be possible for the Medical Association to adopt rules within their confines of what they have with their organization to prohibit their members from doing this type of thing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Krieger, I have no idea in terms of that. I know that for a long time that there were laws against lawyers soliciting business and so forth. They've been changed and adjusted. There were laws against advertising and so forth. But I certainly am not qualified to answer as to what their legal advice has been on that.
And it's interesting that the state bar is not weighed in on this issue at all, so I don't know that they have any concern about it. Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I want to actually agree with, I think, a larger point that they were making. Now, I've only served in this office about 8 weeks now. And during your testimony, I counted up, I can recall off the top of my head at least six different occasions in which we have been asked to create an exception to Oregon's presumption that government records are public. And frankly, in each individual case, like this one, it made a lot of sense. I think all of us were naturally sympathetic to it. However, I'm concerned about a death by a thousand cuts. And I think I'm growing very uneasy with these measures, this one included. And I'm going to have to rethink my approach to that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, we've actually been thinking about it can't be anything that costs money, but something like the press bar, where public records issues through legislative counsel or through the committee chairs, in a sense, would be sent through a vetting process, and a group of people would be able to develop some sort of a better set of criteria. Identity theft is clearly one where that becomes an issue. But they would develop a criteria for what kinds of things should be exempted. Otherwise, the presumption, I think, should be a strong presumption.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would be happy to work with that group on that. Also, particularly, for example, this bill in front of us, -3s, not only create an exception to the public, but actually create an exception to that exception. And I think I'm just concerned that we're rapidly muddying these waters, and I would love to try and bring some clarity to it if it's possible.
Mr. Chair, Representative Barton, the most frustrating thing to me and to Dave representing the media is we never ask for an exemption for the media. We never say, okay, close the record, but let the legitimate media go in. For one thing, you'd have to define what is the legitimate media, which is fairly easy to nobody. And on the other hand, we don't think the media should have access. There's only one place where we have put in a special provision for media, and that's in witnessing the act of execution and the death penalty. And in that case, the argument was made and accepted by all parties that the media were the public representative at that particular act, and the prison people who are involved in the execution and so forth. This is a very significant issue to them. So in almost every case, I think bar none, we've been able to work out a reasonable solution to the problem that does not force us into an either or. But thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Not seeing anyone else signed up to testify on this bill, House Bill 2369. So I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2369. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2631. I'm jumping a little bit out of order. And have up Representative Esquivel. Good afternoon. Welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sal Esquivel, Representative District 6. We have in front of us a bill, 2631, that has to do with contractual renewal in the state of Oregon. What this bill's intent is to disallow people from setting a benchmark in the future on an automatic renewal. And what I mean by that is, example, let's say today I signed you all up for a two-year contract. And if you don't let me know within the next 2 years on a certain day, then it automatically renews for two more years. How many of you would actually remember what date that was? Gilliam, don't try it. So, that's what this is about. It's not about a monthly tenancy. It's not about legitimate renewals. But the ones that bury it in a contract, that automatically renew it if you haven't contacted them at a certain date, and have such an egregious penalty that it's cheaper to go through with the contract for the additional 2 years or 3 years, whatever that may be, because of the horrendous penalty you pay. It is not only unscrupulous, but it's just flat wrong. So that's what this bill will eventually correct. I have asked for some amendments because, of course, we had a meeting with the lobby on this that people had interest in it, and we didn't think about month to month. But unfortunately, I submitted that to the Legislative Council, and the draft, the amendment, is wrong. So it does need amending, and we will continue to work together with the interest groups in order to make sure that we have a good product. No one disputes the fact that we need to stop this kind of practice. In fact, I have received calls from different states that want to pattern something after this when we're all said and done with it. There is another thing that came to light just the last couple of days, and that is if we may have in statute something that will cover this. We are researching that now, myself and Richard Kosasan, to find out and ask LC for an opinion to see if it is, in fact, covered. If it is, that puts a new light on it, and then this bill is actually a moot point. We don't need a bill if there's something in place, but we're not real sure whether it does, in fact, is broad enough to encompass this kind of a problem. That's about all I have to say about this bill, other than the fact that it is a consumer protection bill, and to me, I'm not trying to go out and get the businesses that are legitimate. Example, some of you have cell phones that within 2 years, you have a two-year contract. But after that 2 years, you can pick up your cell phone if you'd like and call your vendor and saying, I want to change and go to a different vendor. That's not a problem. But you do not have to pay 2 years equivalency of your bill in order to do so like these shysters are doing. So I'll entertain any questions.
Questions for Representative Esquivel? Not even a definition of shyster?
You all know what that is.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Representative, for bringing this concept forward. I think it's a concept that deserves consideration, and be interesting to listen to the rest of the testimony and what the issues around this bill are.
Well, Mr. Chair, I would ask your indulgence to hold this bill until such time I get the proper amendments ironed out and the Legislative Council's interpretation of the existing statute.
So we could have this discussion on another day.
Look out.
Any other questions? Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, there is a rumor, and I'm not accusing you of anything, of course, Representative, but does this not apply to the legislature? Because this may be one of the reasons you keep coming back here every time.
Mr. Chair, or Representative Gilliam, it's unfortunate that you aren't in a contract.
Thank you for your testimony today. I appreciate it, and you have a good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Let me go ahead and go forward with this bill. Apologize to going out of order, but up next I have John Powell and Steve Merle.
Yeah, have you talked to him?
Good afternoon again.
Good afternoon, Chair Hovey, members of the committee. Again, Steve Merle, State Farm Insurance. We've signed up as neutral on the bill, primarily just because we saw it and what we're concerned about, and I haven't heard Representative Escobar's testimony. I'm not sure it would apply to us because our contracts are renewable instead of renewed. But every 6 months, we send you out a bill. If you pay the premium, then your contract's renewed. But if you don't, then it's not renewed. We just want to identify ourselves as being a stakeholder in this process and make sure that that doesn't happen, because I'm not sure the members of the public would like to have to come in and affirmatively say, I want to get insurance again. They want to have us send that bill and say, renew it because it's renewable.
Good point. Questions? Seeing none, thank you. John Miller, Mike Sanders, and Jay Chadney.
You want to start and introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Mike Sanders. I own the Albany Athletic Club. I've owned it for 26 years. So.
And I'm Jay Chadney. Good afternoon. I own two health clubs up in Portland.
And my name is John Miller. I own the Courthouse Athletic Clubs here in Salem. We have six locations. We also are a member of an organization called FitLife. There are about 50 privately owned local athletic clubs that are part of this organization. And when we became aware of this bill, our concern is that it's pretty commonplace in our industry to sell a membership that has a one-year term. But at the end of that term, the membership converts to a month-to-month arrangement where the person can cancel with a 30-day notice. And we'd be very concerned. It'd be very burdensome to have to get a positive affirmation from all of these members that they would like to continue. However, we are supportive of what Representative Esquivel described as his intent to make illegal a membership arrangement where at the end of a year, if you did not cancel, your membership was renewed for another one-year term. So any of the three of us would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. So you're saying that at the end of the year, your contract automatically goes to a month-to-month?
Yes.
And so then somebody would have to actively say, or they just stop paying and they would be out?
Well, and
Or would they have to actively say, I want to terminate my my contract?
It varies club by club, and I know in our situation, about half of our memberships join on a month-to-month basis. And so they do need to give us written notification to cancel their membership. If they stop paying dues, then they would be responsible for that last month, which they had not notified us of their intent to cancel. They'd be responsible for the end of that that current month.
Okay. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Chair. I have one question, and that is, when that 1 year is coming up, you don't notify people that they're about to expire, but you put them into a month-to-month on a billing cycle, I assume. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Follow up, please.
All right.
And on that billing, do you mail out the billing, or how does that billing occur?
You know, it varies by club. We do it electronically for folks.
So there is a notification?
Yes. So, but I should say, and I should let Mike and Jay answer this as well. That it varies by club.
That's fine. I'll let them answer too.
Yeah.
But what would be the burden, since you have the electronic notification, and you start notifying them electronically that they owe a month now? What would be the burden in sending them a notification before the end of that year comes up and saying, your year's about up, what do you want to do?
Well, we still have the responsibility of collecting those notifications, dealing with that notification in the office, filing it. I mean, it would be, I mean, in our case, we deal with approximately 20,000 members. So you'd be dealing with, on average, couple thousand of those a month, and the vast majority of our members, they're, like I said, not every one of our members purchases this one-year agreement initially. It's their option. A lot of them join on a month-to-month basis, and so we have members that have been, or in Mike's case, he's owned his club for 26 years, that have paid month-to-month for 26 years.
Okay. And I don't see anything wrong with that. I'm just curious, you know, you're talking about being a burden to notify them. And if you simply sent out a notice that said your year's about up, you're going to go on a month-to-month basis if you don't come and, you know, do something about it. I don't see how that'd be a problem. Anybody else?
No. You wish to address anything, any question you had? Okay. Other questions? Representative Widener.
Just real quick, because you probably do 6 month and year contracts, and then you go to monthly. When they do a yearly contract, is there language that says at the end of the year you'll then be billed on a month-to-month basis or anything like that in your contract?
Chair Holvey, Rep. Widener, yes. Bold print, we make that very clear to folks, so there is no surprise.
So as long as our language makes that clear, because it sounds like you're not any different than a cell phone company or anybody, because cell phones will do 1 and 2 year contracts, and then you know you're on a monthly basis after that. So
yeah,
we just need to make sure you're covered in language.
I think they assume that you want to continue the service until you notify them that you wish to discontinue, and the burden of notifying of that you wish to discontinue is pretty simple. It's a phone call or an email or stop by the club, and it takes 2 minutes.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to be sure I understand this, Mr. Miller, if I do a year with Courthouse, it says when I sign up, you've just signed up for a year. When that's up, unless we hear from you, you're on a month-to-month for as long as you'd like. Is there also a point there at the end of the year where it says, reminder, your year's up and you're going month-to-month unless we hear from you?
Well, again, it varies by club. I'd say the majority of clubs still send out a paper bill that the people write a check and send it in, so you have that reminder every month that you're paying for this service.
Right.
Same thing with ours. We tend to do more electronically, but still the person is paying for the service each month. So I don't know how a person would not understand that they're continuing to purchase this service.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So my question is, I completely understand how burdensome it would be to communicate to each and every one of your clients, of your customers, when they went to the month-to-month. They've probably been on month-to-month for years on end. Well, my question, I guess, is, would it be burdensome at the end of the first year if they had signed up, just to remind them of that, and then it goes on month to month until they say so? It would be less burdensome, perhaps.
Yeah, certainly. I guess I feel like you're solving a problem that, as far as I'm aware, doesn't exist. And so I get nervous as a business person that already has enough challenges to address something that I just don't think in amongst our group of clubs is a problem. And we stay in pretty close contact with the, Attorney General from time to time, and make sure that, and that's really the basis of this group of clubs is, like I said, they're local businesses and family-owned clubs, and we really try and do treat the customer well. That's how we stay in business, and that's why we really support what Representative Esquivel is really trying to accomplish is preventing this automatic renewal of a one-year agreement that automatically renews for another full year.
There's a penalty to back up.
Thank you. Appreciate you coming forward and giving us the perspective from your particular industry. It's important for us to consider.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, I have Jim Craven and Mike Dewey.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Jim Craven on behalf of Tech America. The reason why we're here today is to point out that there are times when people have a contract, even including an automatic renewal clause, that they want, and that is for their benefit. And I'll give you one specific example. Some of you, I hope all of you, have some form of virus checking software, either something that you've gotten for free or something that you pay for with companies like Trend Micro or McAfee or Norton Utilities or whatever. In many cases, it is to your benefit as a consumer to have that continuous coverage and not to, because someone sent you a notice and you forgot to renew, that you have a lapse in coverage. I think where we've had good conversations with Representative Esquivel again about what he's trying to get at this bill, and I think the kernel of it is long-term 12 months or longer automatic renewals that the customer is not provided any notice on, and it just all of a sudden hits their Visa bill and they're stuck for another 12 months. In our conversations, I think that's what he's trying to get to. And the 30-day rollover for your cell phone, I mean, you'd hate to see us, I'll let cell phone people talk for themselves, but you'd hate to see a situation where you had affirmatively get this notice and affirmatively renew, or else one day you pick up your cell phone and it don't work anymore because you forgot to opt back in. I think on when things go to 30 days, you do have a 30-day reminder. Every 30 days, it's called your bill. And if you don't pay it, you have opted out and your service is discontinued. So I think the kernel of the bill as printed really causes grief for almost everybody, because it would disallow an automatic renewal even if the customer at the time of initial contract wanted that. This bill would say that you can't do that. So I think that the sponsor understands that the bill needs a little bit of work, and some of us agree with him on that. I think the key is that at the time of initial contract, the consumer is notified as to the terms. I know in some of the virus checking software, you're asked, would you like this to automatically renew a year from now, so you don't, have a lapse in coverage? And you can say yes or you can say no. Even in the cases I'm familiar with where you have asked for automatic renewal, give me another 12 months when my 12 months is up, you do get notice. Your 12 months is coming up. Remember, you signed up for auto renew. You sure you still want it? So I think there's maybe a kernel of that we can work with on the bill. A lot of us are still checking with people to make sure we don't, do damage inadvertently. But I think that's what Representative Esquivel has said he's trying to get at, that 12-month or longer automatic renewal where you've forgotten that it even existed. And I think there's some room to work with there, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, on behalf of first the Oregon Cable Telecommunications Association, let me speak briefly to our concern. And first, notwithstanding the intent, it's hard to comprehend what this bill does, so we do appreciate the good representative allowing us some time to work through this. For the cable industry, we have what we would call the triple play, which would be a discount for a year for telephone service, high-speed data, and video. And we do have a clause that you have to have that for a year. Otherwise, if you get out early, there is a penalty. So we do have a contract. After that, it is month to month. The contract has expired, and you go month to month, and you can cancel at any time. It wasn't clear in the bill whether or not we would be allowed to do that, and whether or not we'd automatically have to just stop and start all over again with that particular customer. So I think there are others that have that. So I point to that first and something that ought to be clear in the bill. Also, we represent the direct marketers and publishers, and this is the, if you will, kind of the book of the month club, and there are FTC, Federal Trade Commission rules on these kinds of promotions, and I handed out the literature on that in terms of how it works, the disclosure, how you can cancel, what the requirements are, and so forth. And it's somewhat unique in at the first part you get a discount at the end of the contract depending on what you do. You would arguably buy for a book, let's say on a monthly basis if you choose to purchase that book at the regular price as opposed to a discounted price. So it's the record clubs, the book of the month clubs, Reader Digest that are involved in this client that we have. So there are federal rules. And so if somebody was to trying to get at that, and if you wanted to do something in that regard, we would suggest you could put the federal rules into the state statute if you wanted to have a cause of action. We would not have a problem with that because we abide by the federal rules anyway. But we don't want to change the nature of how that program works because an awful lot of people like it. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I know I'm trying to keep you awake, and sometimes it's difficult for me to do that. So there you go.
I don't think anybody even caught that. So not seeing any questions, I think you made your point pretty well. I appreciate you taking a look at it and seeing if there is something that you can do with Representative Esquivel to get at the issue. I think it is a real issue. So, but I recognize the concerns you have as well. Appreciate your testimony, and I almost forgot Brian DeLashmet has signed up as well.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian DeLashmet representing Sprint Nextel today. I'll be extremely brief. The issue for us is the month-to-month. I have supplied the language that you're going to see to represent Esquivel for us after a two-year contract. We would suggest that it go to month-to-month, and we believe we have the language that's being suggested that would accomplish that, and we would be totally satisfied. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Don't see any questions for you. Thank you. Appreciate the language, too. Not seeing anyone else left to testify on this one, I'm going to close public hearing on House Bill 2631 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2325. And first up, I'd like Tom D'Amore, Shannon Olmsted, and Neil Jackson. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee. And if you would identify yourselves before your testimony begins. Thank you.
Tom D'Amore with the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Representative Hope Holby, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to come today to talk about this very important consumer bill, House Bill 2325. First thing, in looking at the hearing agenda, I noticed a typo. And the one thing I wanted to make clear through my testimony anyway was this bill only applies to PIP benefits when the losses are greater than the benefits available. So it's in those cases, the more egregious cases, where there's just not enough coverage to go around to pay for all the damages suffered. Wanted to make that point right off the bat.
Thank you.
As you know, PIP coverage in Oregon is mandatory. Everybody has to buy PIP coverage with their auto policy. The rub in this with and the reason for this particular bill is that when somebody does suffer a more serious injury and there's not enough coverage to go around, at the end of the day when it's time to pay off the policy, for instance, if the at-fault party that caused the injury only has a $25,000 policy and you've got a serious injury where the claim is worth more than that, the PIP coverage of $15,000 that was paid originally has to be paid back to the insurance carrier. So out of that amount of $25,000, which isn't enough anyway, you've got to take $15,000 out of that $25,000 and pay the PIP carrier. HB 2325 reverses that order such that when somebody is seriously injured, the injured person will get the proceeds of the $25,000 first, and if there's anything left over, then the PIP carrier would get reimbursed. For instance, in a case where there's a lot of coverage, it's never an issue because the person will be made whole by the settlement or whatever the verdict is, and then the PIP carrier gets reimbursed for the whatever amount of PIP benefits they paid out. Typically, we talk about medical expenses, but there's also wage loss benefits where, for instance, the injured party could get wage loss benefits in addition to their medical records, medical bills, and then at the end of the day, they would have to reimburse under current law both the wage loss benefits they got and the medical benefits. And so the gist of this bill simply reverses that order so that the injured party is made whole first. If there's additional benefits left over, then the PIP insurer gets reimbursed. With that, if there are any questions, I'd be glad to answer them. Chair Holden.
Maybe I'll start with one. I'm just trying to clarify the situation. So you're telling me that a person buys insurance, and so when a claim's made on that insurance by another party, the insurance company gets somehow reimbursed before the consumer does?
Correct. If that injured consumer made a claim against an at-fault party, the at-fault party had a $25,000 policy, then from that $25,000 policy, the PIP carrier gets their $15,000, assuming they paid back their $15,000 or paid a total of $15,000, they get paid back first under the policy, and then the injured party would have the remaining $10,000, for instance, if they had other medical expenses that had to be paid and all other costs, that's all they would have left. Under the current law, if the...
So the insurance is covering the insurance company?
In effect, basically the insurance company is making a loan to the injured party. And they'll have to reimburse it unless the economic damages are so high, they're required to reimburse under current law.
Questions, Representative Winger?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do not claim to be an expert in this or any field of law, but. From our meeting and my giving a little opportunity to digest this, it seems to me that in one way to characterize this is it's sort of doubling a person's coverage. Because right now, right, if they access the other person's coverage, they're forced to repay what they were given out of their own insurance carriers, the coverage they had. Under this bill, getting paid first means it's kind of a way of doubling my coverage, because I can get reimbursed up to my limit from my insurance carrier, and then if I am able to receive an award from the person who hit me, I don't necessarily have to reimburse my insurance carrier. So I ended up with more than I'm currently getting out of the way law is situated now.
You're currently getting more, but it's not a double recovery, because if the value of your claim is $50,000, and there's only a $25,000 policy, you under this legislation, you'd get the $25,000 policy, and you'd get, say, the $15,000 of medical that was already been paid. So that's a total of $40,000. The value of your claim is $50,000. You're still got a $10,000 shortfall.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. Right. So, but under the current law, what I'm entitled to is essentially, I mean, assuming the other person doesn't have assets, what I'm likely to get is the limit that they have on their insurance. And my own insurance company expects to be reimbursed if they've paid out on some of this that was the other person's fault. So I agree that it doesn't happen in all scenarios, but in a number of scenarios, what's going to happen here is that I've essentially raised the limit of accessible money because I can get paid out of my own insurance company for an accident and then go after the other person's limit and end up, I agree with you, it may not be the total amount of damages that were done, but I have essentially increased the access I have to money to recoup for my loss.
Chair Holby, Representative Wingard, yes, you're correct. You've increased the amount to that injured person that they're able to recover. Even if there's a shortfall, it does definitely increase the amount that the injured person can recover.
One final question.
Go ahead.
So the my final question would be then, I mean, in this large pool where we're all insured, if the amount of money that can be paid out has increased, which is what you've just agreed essentially can happen now, we would expect rates to increase as well to compensate for that. So can you give me some idea of what kind of an insurance rate increase would follow on this bill?
Well, Chair Holy, Representative Wingard, I really don't know that it's going to increase. Typically, the way insurance premiums are set are based upon how much revenue or premiums they bring in versus the losses. And in this case, it's sort of a reimbursement back to the insurance carrier. It's not necessarily a loss to them. So I think that both Mr. Jackson and the insurers could probably talk to you better about that. But it's in this case, policy limits are not increasing. There's no additional exposure. The policy limits are remaining the same. It's just a reimbursement or a shifting back of money.
Mr. Chair, just if I could come back to that question again.
One more.
Thank you. Okay, but if I'm State Farm or Allstate or one of these, I have thousands of accidents going on. Sometimes my client's at fault, sometimes I'm the aggrieved party and I'm getting reimbursement. So the individual may be coming out, may be in a better situation as a result of this change, but overall in the big pool from the insurance standpoint, if you agree with me that in many cases this is equivalent to increasing a person's access to insurance payments, that means more money's flowing out from the insurance companies. And I don't know of any scenario where more money flows out from the insurance company that doesn't result in that additional money being passed on to the ratepayers in higher costs. So I cannot follow the argument that we're going to create more payout and that that's not going to raise rates for people.
Chair Holby, Representative Wingard, and I can't speak to that, but I can tell you that the PIP portion of the policy, the premium, is not a very big amount, $30 to $50 every 6 months. So even if there was some increase, it's going to be minor. And again, these cases, HB 2325 only applies to the cases where there's not enough insurance available. All other cases, the insurer is going to be reimbursed in full. So if there is a bump up in premium, it would be minor for those reasons.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Widener.
Real quick, because my mind's kind of gotten refreshed here a little bit after listening to the testimony, but wasn't one of the reasons behind this was to recover, open the door to where someone, if they were getting shortchanged, they felt in their PIP program where they could afford to hire an attorney because there would be extra money there for reimbursement? Seems like we discussed something like that when you're in my office. I can't.
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, could you repeat that? I'm not sure if I can.
Well, with the additional insurance, because it seems like we're dealing with issues where a person, you know, they had a valid claim, but they couldn't come up with, there wasn't enough for an attorney to get involved, and then with the double coverage, there was actually enough where you guys could jump in and help somebody settle a claim. I think was part of the reasoning behind this, if I remember right, when we were talking. It was a long time ago, so.
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, I think in cases where you've got this situation, some attorneys would not take the case because there's not enough money to go around in order to make the person whole. So if that's what you're referring to, I think that is a possibility that attorneys really can't get involved in that kind of a case.
Right, and with it doubling up would given an opportunity to possibly get involved.
Chair Holby, Representative Widener, I don't like to call it doubling up because the insured is, in my example, still not made whole, but agreed.
Thank you. Any other questions? Just briefly, this seems like sort of a fundamental switch, I guess, or change from what practice in Oregon is right now. What's the experience in other states? Are there other states that have the model that's being proposed in this bill as opposed to what Oregon currently has? I'm just kind of, do you have information about that?
Yes, Chair Holby. The state of Washington is a perfect example. They have what's called the make whole rule. So it's basically HB 2325. If somebody is injured, the person has to be made whole before any PIP benefits are paid back to the PIP carrier. And just like under this bill, if there's enough insurance available, the person will get paid, settle their claim for whatever it's worth, and then the PIP carrier would get reimbursed the remainder out of the policy, the at-fault person's policy. So Washington is a good example, and the premiums are not significantly higher. Mr. Jackson's going to speak more to that. And also, Washington allows for a 3-year period in which to make a claim. Oregon only allows for 1 year, and that is one additional amendment to HB 2325 that I haven't talked about, and that's to increase the period of when the benefits are available to 2 years. But again, the amount of the policy limits not increased at all.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and let Mr. Jackson or whoever wants to go next.
Can I go next?
Oh. Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
Chair Holby and members of the committee, I'm Shannon Olmsted from Gladstone, Oregon. I appreciate everyone listening to my story today. It's been a little over a year ago. I was parked in front of a store in Oregon City when I'm talking on my cell phone. I'm not seatbelted. I'm just minding my own business when a truck slams in the back of me. And from there, I was left with a fractured elbow and other injuries. Previous to that accident, I was still recovering from a drunk driving accident where I was hit head-on and had extensive damages. But through the course of my medical treatment, then being released from the doctors, I did hire an attorney when I didn't get any satisfaction from the insurance carrier. But then it was realized that the party that hit me had the minimum limit of $25,000. And my policy then, excuse me, I have a 30-60 policy with Farmers. Now that things, I was trying to get everything resolved, my attorney tells me that there's a check. The other carrier has issued a check for the policy limit. It's now being held in a trust fund because Farmers wants their medical that they paid out. They want that back, which the medical bills were over $21,000 plus when Farmers quit paying, I had like 3 months left of treatment. So there's 3 months worth of bills still outstanding. So by the time those bills are paid and Farmers gets their $21,000 back, out of that $25,000, there's nothing left, and I still owe money for doctor bills. So that's my story, and I hope that you'll take this bill into consideration and support, you know, 2325 and reverse this so that, you know, it doesn't happen to other people. And I mean, I urge everyone to reevaluate their insurance policies. Since then, I have tripled mine so that we are covered. And also, one last thing is that there's absolutely no compensation left over for my injuries, for my loss of work, for any other appointments that I might have to have in the future. If in fact that Farmers gets their medical back. But this is going to be an ongoing process for 3 to 4 months is what my attorney's telling me to try and get something resolved.
Thank you. So,
again, thank you.
I appreciate you coming forward and telling us your personal story and putting a face on the issue. Questions from the committee? Representative Krieger.
The bill we passed the other day, I carried on the floor, changed it to $3,000 for the lost wages.
That's so right.
That's different than what's in here.
Correct.
This would be updated to whatever that was.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Neil Jackson. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Tribal Lawyers also. I'm going to be fairly short, but I want to point out a few things. The issue is always how much the premiums are going to be. I've had the opportunity to talk to some of you. We did the research on the premiums. Washington has a $10,000 PIP minimum limit, $10,000 of coverage. We investigated three different companies, Farmers, Mutual of Unumclaw, and State Farm. The cost for 10,000 PIP coverage in Washington is between $37 and $41 every 6 months. The cost of $15,000, which is Oregon's minimum, the cost of $15,000 in PIP coverage is $36 for 6 months in Oregon. I have $25,000 on my policy, and that costs me $10 a month. $60 every 6 months. A $35,000 policy in Washington for 6 months is $90, so it's about $15 a month. Those are the numbers you're looking at, and keep in mind, in Washington, they don't have the reimbursement law that we do. You don't always have to pay back the insurance company first. The consumer gets made whole first. I've been down here before with this bill. I'm going to repeat one of the arguments that I heard made last session. Doom and gloom, the sky's going to fall, we're going to be just like Colorado, we're not going to be able to afford PIP. I investigated what happened in Colorado, and Oregon has absolutely nothing in common with what happened in Colorado. We have price controls, we have administrative rules that govern how much the care providers can charge for the services they render. The Workers' Comp Board designed or came up with those rules. So we've got that cost control. We've got limits. In Colorado, their limit was $100,000 per year for 5 years, and it was breaking the insurance companies. We have limits that we pay for. You're paying premium for what your limits are. And finally, even with the -1 amendment to this bill, your PIP would only be payable for 2 years, and it's still, the limit is still there. It's not going up to $100,000 or anything like that. That was the problem in Colorado. Finally, last night, as I was thinking about coming down here, I went and got out my policy to see if I could find in there where it told me that I had to reimburse my PIP carrier. I think if you look at your own policies, you'll see it does not say you have to reimburse your PIP carrier for whatever they pay you. My policy says, reimbursement and trust. In the event of payment to any person under this endorsement, we shall be entitled to reimbursement or subrogation in accordance with the provisions of the Oregon Insurance Code. It doesn't even tell you. I think people pay premiums and expect to have coverage. I can tell you finally, when my clients find out that they have to reimburse PIP like this lady, they get very angry. And they all say the same thing. What have I been paying for? Because the way it is right now, you're just taking out a loan and you got to pay it back. Thank you. You have, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, you have a submission by Steve Mill, I think, was handed to you about a client of his in a similar situation to this nice lady here.
Thank you. Did you provide us the research you did on the insurance companies?
I can do that.
State of Washington, just so we can look at those numbers?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will.
Thank you. Questions? From the committee? Not seeing any. Thank you for your testimony this afternoon. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Next up, we have some others. As soon as I find them. Oh, they're there. Steve Merle, Sean Miller, and John Powell.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. With me is Mr. Steve Merle from State Farm. And Mr. Chairman, I think in light of the time, I'll just have Steve go through our reading of the bill and what it does.
Chair Holby, members of the committee, again, Steve Merle with State Farm Insurance. The bill you have in front of you would alter personal injury protection law, which we commonly call PIP, in allowing a injured party to recover all their damages. That means their economic loss or pain and suffering losses before an insurance company is able to recover their PIP. Just to kind of back off a little bit and take a look at the PIP coverage. PIP coverage is a coverage that was brought into Oregon in the 1970s. At that time, there was concern about the tort system, whether it was going to continue to be viable, and whether we should go to a no-fault system. Oregon, instead of tinkering with a no-fault system like some states did at that time, had each liability policy have personal injury protection coverage. That coverage is designed to pay for your medical bills without fault whenever you get in an accident. A committee much like this one in the 70s was sitting on that bill, and the biggest concern they had when they did it was, is it going to be too expensive for consumers to have once we get it out there? Many states that got PIP, and all the PIP coverages in all the states are different, went down tracks and modified where benefits got more generous and couldn't afford anymore. Today, only about 13 states in the United States have personal injury protection coverage. You'll find they're all homegrown solutions. There's no commonality between them. One of the Oregon solutions to cost early on in the personal injury protection law was to say, if I am a personal injury protection insurer and I pay on behalf of my insured but another party is at fault, I'm allowed to go and recover that money from the at-fault party before the insured gets $1. And that was the way it ran for many years. The insurance company was reimbursed everything first. As time went on, that rule was felt to be harsh, and the current statute you have in front of you, ORS 742-544, was enacted to modify that rule. And it's modified today in that what happens, the insured is allowed to recover all of their economic loss. That would mean all of their medical bills that were paid by PIP or not paid by PIP, all of their wage loss, anything that's out of pocket that's economic, before the insurer is allowed to recover their money. What this bill proposes to do is expand that from just being made whole economically to being made whole both economically and non-economically. Non-economically, what I mean by that is pain and suffering. This will cause less situations where you recover your personal injury protection subrogation. That's significant because what you do to calculate rates is what your ultimate loss is. Your ultimate loss is what you paid out minus any recoveries. So every dollar I recover back on behalf of an insured reduces my ultimate loss, and it impacts what the PIP coverage price is going to be. Now, this committee has already passed out one bill that, if it goes through the Senate, will raise wage loss benefits. As we pay more wage loss and our ultimate loss goes up, we'll be needing to raise our rates. The same thing will happen with this one if it goes out, and it reduces the recoveries we have. One added thing that I would point out that in other states where I've seen this type of made-whole rule operating, you generate disputes. A lot of lawyers never believe that their client ever got enough money to make their pain and suffering whole. And I've seen some incredible disputes generated where it's obvious the person was made whole, but yet an attorney's trying to argue they aren't. And so you end up with disputes over that money. We're not in favor of this bill as it is proposed because it would increase costs for personal injury protection coverage. But if you were to do anything like this, I would encourage you to consider some sort of expedited dispute resolution, because in other states, that's where I've seen a lot of money and a lot of frustration that doesn't need to exist by not having an expedited dispute resolution. That concludes my testimony. If there's, I think Mr. Miller has some things to add.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Property Casualty Insurers Association, and just want to express our concerns with House Bill 2325. I think to answer just a few questions, I think the chair brought up of how many states do not allow for subrogation or reimbursement. I think the research that we've done is about 14 states that do not allow for subrogation or reimbursement from PIP benefits, and I have a list of those states with the actual loss costs associated with them that I'm happy I will provide that. I just received that today, so I will provide that to the committee following the hearing. But in those 14 states, 11 of those states have higher loss costs, which I think brings us back to a question that Representative Winger brought up, that we do believe that, you know, because of loss costs is such a key factor in determining rates, you will see evidence of passing House Bill 2325 that it will be reflected in the costs of what people will pay for their insurance. So we just want to raise that concern that because the we believe by removing economic in House Bill 2325 and including non-economic, that will always exceed or in most cases exceed the total amount, and therefore not allow an insurer to seek reimbursement or subrogation. So again, Mr. Chair, I do have that chart of those states and those losses. I will provide that to the committee. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I look forward to seeing that chart, too. I'm just curious if you can address, I mean, as in the previous testifiers were mentioning the state of Washington, where their process is similar to the proposal in House Bill 2325, and they have evidently a three-year limit, and they're proposing a two-year here. So I'm just, and their premiums don't seem to be very much different than what somebody would pay here. So do they have an expedited dispute resolution in the state of Washington?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, I've actually worked in the state of Washington. I'm licensed to practice up there both. They don't have an expedited dispute resolution mechanism in their law at all. The horror stories I could share with you come from the state of Washington, though, where you end up in situations where people overreach to keep money when their client was obviously made whole. I would caution also in trying to compare the state of Washington. If you look at the state of Washington in general, the trending I did, and I don't have current data on it, and the data is almost always 2 years out of whack. Overall insurance costs for car insurance in Washington have been going up dramatically versus Oregon. To the last time I looked at it, they were at either equal or slightly exceeding the cost of insurance in California. The other thing that you have to be careful of in the state of Washington and costs in general is the state of Washington does not mandate as much coverage as we have. We tell you have to have PIP. No choice about it. It comes with liability coverage. Up there, insurance companies are required to offer $35,000 in PIP. You can say, no, I want a lower amount of $10,000, or you can reject it completely. And there are a number of other coverages in Washington that I can reject completely to affect my insurance bill, like an uninsured motorist. I could reject that up there if I wanted to and just not carry that. That's not the case here. So I think it's a very apples and oranges from a cost standpoint to try to mix those two. It would be I'm not sure how fair it would be to try to compare the two.
Well, I'm not sure if I follow you quite. I mean, if we're talking about the same dollar amount of coverage, and we're talking about a proposal that's similar to the state of Washington, and our limit is even a year less. I mean, why isn't that an apple-to-apple comparison?
Yeah. Chair Hovey, members of the committee, I don't know where those numbers came from, and I have to check to even see if I can get those. In the past, one of the difficulties with PIP costs is I've been told with State Farm, it is part of the liability premium, and so it's hard to sort out. So I don't know where those numbers came from, and they just... You know, I'm sure that Mr. Jackson did his best to get the right numbers, but they didn't sound right to me when I was sitting there. And I can double-check to see what I can find out, but I don't know what I will be able to find out.
Yeah. Well, it'd be interesting to look at that comparison if it is as close to an apple and an apple comparison as we can get. And I mean, that might be useful information for the committee.
And Chair Hovey, if I could also mention... As we're talking about these things, I don't know that they ever are dramatic increases. And I think we're always raised to think of the one straw that broke the camel's back, when it's never the one straw. It's the collective weight of all the straws. And as we're making these decisions, that's what I try to emphasize to the committee, is each one of them has an independent effect as to what it does to coverage and where it pushes the cost up.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Matthews.
Well, thank you, Chair Hovey. And with respect to that comment, which I appreciate, you know, customers ultimately will have a choice, and so will some of the insurance providers. I don't necessarily know that every insurance provider will raise their rate. I don't know if that's going to be the case. So I guess my only point is that, you know, that in the scenario that they discussed, I could see where some people might say, what is my insurance for if the first person that gets reimbursed is the insurance company I've been paying premium to? So I could see where, from a consumer protection end of things, where the average consumer would think, why am I paying insurance when really the end result is it's not benefiting me greatly? It's going to, you know, there's no real chance in the insurance part. So when we talk about increase, I just want to say again that people have a choice, you know, and they have a choice on who they do insurance with and how they conduct their business. And insurance also has a choice in terms of what they're going to do if this should pass.
Representative Wagner.
Thank you, Chair. I'd be kind of curious on those numbers, because we just went from $1,250 a month to $3,000 a month, I believe, on the PIP for the monthly payouts. And then we went from 15 to 25?
20.
Or to 20? And that lasts. So we made a pretty big jump in the PIP already. And then if we're going to go this direction, I'm just a little nervous to throw two things onto PIP in one session. And it's not the consumer making a choice at this point. It's really us mandating and saying this is what you'll do. So we're almost saying, I mean, I guess, do we want to make the policy decision in a complete separate thing on how much coverage we really should have on our auto insurance? Because that's what the state of Oregon really should be looking at, rather than just picking on one little piece of the pie here. I don't know. One of you guys wanted
comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman. John Powell again, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Mr. Chairman, I would encourage the committee to look at the bill on line 7, at the only changes made there is the elimination of the word economic, and that is defined in ORS 31710, which would tell you exactly what has to be recovered on the part of the claimant before an insurance company subrogates. The insurance company would not step in front of that. That person has to be made whole economically, and that statute lays out exactly what all those elements of economic recovery are prior to an insurer being able to recover. So they do not step in front of the claimant in terms of economic loss.
Representative Wingard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. From my mind, I think it's clear that every time we pass one of these, we are essentially creating a rate increase. It may not be very much, but I want to go at this point of the little amounts adding up and give you a comparison that I know a little bit more about, which is all the Oregon's health insurance mandates. We have, I think, over 33 health insurance mandates. And I've read some research that shows the average insurance mandate that a state passes ends up raising premiums by $1 to $5 per month. doesn't seem like very much, but once you have 33 mandates layered on your health insurance in the state, you're looking at somewhere between $33 and $150-$160 a month people are paying because of those mandates that you placed on. So, you know, I'm sure that the one we already passed is a few dollars more a month, and this one probably is, you know, if it were scored out, is a few more dollars a month. But again, my concern remains about, and there is research out there that shows that for every dollar in which insurance goes up in cost, you have an increased number of people who are no longer insured at all. And I guess the other point I would ask, just in general, is that I think when we're going to have a number of bills that are all in one way or another going to raise, in this case, auto insurance rates, I think it would be a good idea to consider them all together and to make a decision about whether we want to pass them all or to prioritize which ones we think might be most important at this point. I'm just a little troubled about doing it in pieces where we take them on their merits at the time and we kind of blow off the idea that it's $1 to $5, but their cumulative effect is a little bit harder for the folks out there who end up paying these premiums to take. So I just wanted to put that concern out there. Thank you.
Appreciate your concern, and if I had complete cooperation of legislative council and all the amendments coming out at the same time, it would be a little easier, but I think this bill is still pretty fresh in our mind with the bill that we just passed out. So anyway, with respect, Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The figures that I can recall from last year and the year the two sessions before was that for each mandate, about 3,000 Oregonians would lose coverage in health care. And then I just did check after about raising my own liability and stuff in my own personal automobile, and to where I need to go is about $267 a year increase to get the coverage I want. So it does
add up. Mm. Representative Matthews.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'll be brief. And I want to let people know, too, I'm not 100% committed to this bill in by any way, shape, or form. I'm looking into the issue, but when I hear us, you know, the collective us, I guess, say every time we pass or every time we do one of these or every time, you know, let's remember, too, that this PIP was unchanged for how many years? And I guarantee my rates did increase for all those years. And it wasn't because the PIP increased by any sense of the word. So think about collateral damage of inaction as well and what may occur if we don't do something. So that's what I would suggest to the group. And again, I'm undecided, but I think we have a responsibility to look at this from every angle, and I want to encourage too, don't forget the fact that PIP was unchanged for all those years, and yet I didn't enjoy any offset in my insurance as a result of that. Just a thought.
No other questions for you today, you except for me. I don't think any of you commented on the Dash 1 amendment that changes the amount or the limit from 1 year to 2 years, and do you or maybe you haven't had time to see
Chairman,
it.
We just saw it today.
Oh, okay.
So, thank you.
Well, maybe you can think about it.
You will.
Comment to me later then. So anyway, appreciate
thank you.
Appreciate your testimony today. Committee, we've heard a couple of bills today that two of them were on possible work session, and we're not going to move either of the bills today. We've had a little bit of time to look at the amendments. I want people to have time to digest these amendments and have further conversations if you so need, and before we have these bills come back. So with that, I think I'm going to, no one else is signed up to testify on House Bill 2325. I'm going to adjourn the, or excuse me, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2325, and I am going to adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection.
Thank you.